My name is Amy Hotelling, and I probably have met most of you here, but my husband and I, we have been at Riverside 4.5 years now, I think. Like, I can't believe it's been that long, but we've been here about 4.5 years, and we both work at Hope Ministries in downtown South Bend, and we lead a home group that meets in Marquette Park. So we're pretty involved. We like this church. We've been here a little while. And today, I'm going to share with you from, it's kind of the end of Luke 22, beginning of Luke 23, and we're going to talk about a couple of trials, like legal trials, that Jesus went through right before he was executed. And I don't know, I don't know about you guys, but this is kind of a part of the Bible, like, I don't really like to think about very much. Like, Jesus was killed, he was tortured, he was verbally abused, he was mocked, he was ridiculed. It was like not just like the legal punishment, but like beyond, you know, adding insult to injury, above and beyond what they really needed to do. And I don't like to think about that when that happens to good people. I don't like to dwell on it. I don't like to spend a lot of mental energy on it. I especially don't like to think about it when it is a good, innocent person, and I especially don't like to think about it a whole lot when I know that really it was my sin that put him there. So it's not something, you know, that most of us enjoy. However, the authors of the Gospels, so Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the ones that are the main biographers of Jesus' life, they dedicated a disproportionate amount of time to the last week of Jesus' life before he got executed. So sometimes we call that Holy Week. Sometimes people refer to it as the Passion, which sounds kind of weird today, you know, because we don't usually use that word like that, but Passion also means suffering. So the authors of the Gospels, I mean, Jesus was around on earth, you know, before the resurrection. He was around for 33 years. The last 3 years of his life were what we call his public ministry. And Holy Week, the last week of his life, that was just 1 week out of 33 years. But the gospel writers, they dedicate a ton of time in their gospels to that 1 week. Luke, who, of course, we've been studying for, 72 weeks now? How many of you were here at the beginning of the Luke series? Okay. Mostly. How many weeks has it been now? Something. It's been a long time. So Luke actually dedicates the least proportion of all the gospel writers to the Holy Week. He only dedicates about 17% of Luke. But still, that's 17% dedicated to 1 week of Jesus' life. Matthew dedicates about a fourth of his gospel is all about that 1 week of Jesus' life. 1 week out of 3 years of public ministry. And Mark and John, one-third of the gospels of Mark and John are about this 1 week. So this might not be the passages we really like to focus on, but the gospel writers thought they were pretty important. So I think they must be. It must be really important that we think about this and meditate on this. So we'll start by reading today's passage. If you guys can stand with me to read from the gospel. We'll start in verse 63. That is not... Okay, so if you want to open your Bibles, we're Luke 22:63. And that was Keith's passage from last week. It's what we that's what we covered there. But so if you can open your Bibles or on your smartphones or whatever, Luke 22:63 is where we're going to start, and we're going to read through 23:12. The men who were guarding Jesus began mocking and beating him. They blindfolded him and demanded, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And they said many other insulting things to him. At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. "If you are the Messiah," they said, "tell us." Jesus answered, "If I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I asked you, you would not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." They all asked, "Are you the Son of God?" He replied, "You say that I am." Then they said, "Why do we need any more testimony? We have heard it from his own lips." Then the whole assembly rose and led him off to Pilate. And they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Messiah, a king." So Pilate asked Jesus, "Are you the king of the Jews?" "You have said so," Jesus replied. Then Pilate announced to the chief priests and the crowd, "I find no basis for a charge against this man." But they insisted, "He stirs up the people all over Judea by his teaching. He started in Galilee and has come all the way here." On hearing this, Pilate asked if the man was a Galilean. When he learned that Jesus was under Herod's jurisdiction, he sent him to Herod, who was also in Jerusalem at that time. When Herod saw Jesus, he was greatly pleased, because for a long time he had been waiting to see him. From what he had heard about him, he hoped to see him perform a sign of some sort. He plied him with many questions, but Jesus gave him no answer. The chief priests and the teachers of the law were standing there, vehemently accusing him. Then Herod and his soldiers ridiculed and mocked him. Dressing him in an elegant robe, they sent him back to Pilate. That day, Herod and Pilate became friends. Before this, they had been enemies. You can be seated. So our passage today, just to give you guys a little like time, order, context, it begins the same night that Jesus was betrayed. So it actually begins right after the sermon that Cedric preached a couple weeks ago. We went out of order a little bit. So if you guys remember, Jesus says, "Peter, you're going to deny me three times." And on the third time that Peter denies Jesus, the rooster crows, and Jesus looks straight at Peter. Our passage begins immediately after that. So it's the same night Jesus was betrayed, and he just looked at Peter, and then it turns to Luke starts talking about the temple guards mocking him and abusing him. So these were the temple guards. These are not Roman soldiers. These are people that work for the Jewish leadership. They guard the temple. They're like local guards. And so they work for the Jewish leadership. They probably were the same guards that arrested Jesus in the garden. We don't know for sure. But they begin to abuse Jesus. And they start hitting him and striking him. And they would say, "Prophesy, who hit you?" And Jesus has blindfold around him so he can't see. So they're basically saying, "You know, you say you're a prophet, tell us who hit you." And they would hit him again and again and again and say, "Who hit you?" I mean, really, really verbally abusive, really, really mean and disrespectful to Jesus. It was kind of an ancient form of blind man's bluff. And I think about them and I think, why was this necessary? Like, what did they have against Jesus? These people, Jesus didn't do anything to him. They weren't even, I can understand a little bit why the Pharisees and the Sadducees were kind of mad at Jesus, because he was threatening their power. Like, they were worried he was more popular than them, and they felt threatened by him. But like the temple guards, like what's the deal? And I think we see this today too, when there are certain jobs and certain positions that it's very tempting to lord it over someone that appears to be weaker than you. And so I think they were drawn into that a little bit. Everybody wants to be better than somebody else. Everybody wants to have power over somebody else, and they could have power over Jesus, so they were going to abuse him even though he had done nothing to them. They also could have done this because, as Jesus said earlier in this passage, he said, "This was the hour when darkness reigns." So there was a lot of evil, demonic activity going on here. The gospel writers make that very clear. So that's how Luke closes the scene that night, is with Jesus being struck and being ridiculed for being a prophet. So we turn to the first thing the next morning in verse 66. Luke writes, "At daybreak, the council of the elders of the people, both the chief priests and the teachers of the law, met together, and Jesus was led before them. 'If you are the Messiah,' they said, 'tell us so.'" So the religious leaders here, they had one goal. They wanted the death penalty. They wanted Jesus done away with. They didn't want him in jail. They didn't want him beaten. They wanted him dead. Now, who is this council of the elders? Because if you read the Gospels, you hear a lot about the council of the elders. We hear all these words all the time that are thrown out, and they just, I don't know, for me, they kind of all blur together, and they get real confusing, and I get people mixed up, and I can't remember who's who. So I had to kind of look these up and review these, so I'm going to share a little bit, just some definitions of who these people are. So the council of the elders in the Gospels, when it talks about this, sometimes, have you guys heard, like, the Sanhedrin, that word, some translations say? It was the same thing. And as Luke says, it was the teachers of the law and the Sadducees. So it included the Sanhedrin, which was the Jewish high court. Also, the Sadducees were part of that. So it was like the Jewish nobility, the families of the priests. So that was kind of one group. And then the other group was the scribes. So what were who were the scribes? We hear about them a lot. Sometimes they're called the experts of the law. So the scribes were not priests. They were they were lay people. They weren't of the tribe of Levi. They were not serving in the temple. They weren't allowed to serve in the temple. They were lay people, but they had become experts in how to apply the law. And usually when you talk about the law in the Bible, it's talking about the books of Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and Deuteronomy, the Torah, which is the first five books of the Old Testament. And the scribes, who were also the Pharisees. So the Pharisees, there's a bunch of Pharisees, and some of the Pharisees were scribes, but pretty much all the scribes were Pharisees. The scribes were experts. They knew the scriptures really, really, really well, probably better than any of us here. And they put a huge emphasis on oral tradition. So what they were doing is, like, how do you interpret the scriptures in your day and age? So the Torah, like Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, those books were written a long time before Jesus, like hundreds of years before Jesus, and times had changed. So it was hard to know, like, how do we apply this one law that was written in Moses' time kind of to Moses' people? How do we apply that today in, like, 30 AD? So they came up with all these ways about how to apply the rules and regulations of the Old Testament. And they created all these traditions about, like, this is how you do it today. And it's not necessarily wrong, but they really put as much emphasis on their oral traditions and their own interpretations as they did on the scriptures themselves. And sometimes even more emphasis on their own rules and interpretations than they did on the Bible itself. And Jesus, he wasn't as into the oral traditions, so he clashed with them a lot. A lot of the arguments that we studied all throughout Luke, when Jesus is arguing with the scribes and the Pharisees, they were mad at him because he did not follow their oral interpretation. Now, again, this stuff wasn't necessarily in scripture, but they basically took it as scripture. So Jesus clashed with them a lot. So the other half of the council of the elders was the Sadducees, or the priestly class. Now, ironically, they weren't so focused on oral tradition. It wasn't as big of a deal to them. And I think that's kind of why we don't hear about them as much in the Gospels, because they didn't really fight with Jesus as much. They didn't really care if he was clashing with the Pharisees' oral interpretation. They didn't really follow it either. So he did not clash as much with the priestly class. But regardless, they're all here together now, the council of the elders and the scribes and Pharisees, and they all feel threatened by him, and they all want him dead. All of them, both groups, regardless. So they say, they just cut right to the chase. If you're the Messiah, tell us, they said. And Jesus, he doesn't really answer them. He knows their minds are made up. This isn't a real trial. They're not really trying to figure out what he believes and whether or not he's innocent. They're just looking for a way to get him killed. So he doesn't really say. He says, if I tell you, you will not believe me. And if I ask you, you would not answer. So basically saying, you've made up your minds, I'm not going to answer you. And this is pretty, you know, this is pretty classic Jesus. Like, if you look through the questions people ask Jesus in the Bible, he does not directly answer very many of them. He usually comes back with another question or some other statement or whatever. So, you know, pretty true to how he usually acted. He just said, you know, you've already made up your minds, I'm not going to tell you. However, we know from what he said right after that, he's not trying to avoid the truth or be subtle or keep from being punished or not say anything bold, because what he says after that is very bold and very challenging. Right after that, he makes it's really a crazy claim. He says, "From now on, the Son of Man will be seated at the right hand of the mighty God." And that is a bold claim. Imagine yourself being in a courtroom and there's a pastor on trial and people are mad at him and they're saying, "What are you doing?" And he says, "From now on, I'm going to be in heaven seated next to God." You'd be like, "Okay, you're crazy." So it was a bold claim. It was very offensive to them. And it's an even bolder, more offensive claim back in that day to the Jewish people than it probably would be now, because it meant some things that are kind of different to them than what it would mean to us. The Jewish people of that time, and a lot of them today too, they put a huge, huge emphasis on God's holiness. So his separateness, his uniqueness, his being completely different from people and everything on earth. The Jews of that time, and a lot of Jews today too, they won't say God's name out loud. They will not say Yahweh. They won't voice it. They won't say it. And they won't even write it completely out, because they're so reverent. They want to be so separate and so other. And the Greek Septuagint, which is the Greek translation of the Old Testament, which is what a lot of people read in those days, because a lot of them, they didn't really speak Hebrew anymore. They spoke Aramaic. Greek was more widely spoken. The Septuagint was the translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. It was the authority. It was scripture as much as the Hebrew was in most people's minds. So when they translated that, which, I don't know, it was maybe 100 years before Christ, there were certain passages. If you read the Old Testament and the New Testament, you'll read things that they don't make God exactly sound like a person, but they'll give him some, I don't know, kind of human characteristics, like things like, "Is God's hand so short that he cannot save?" Or, "His eyes blind and he cannot see?" Like things like that give him, like, kind of sounds like maybe he has body parts, even though he doesn't. When they translated that into Greek, they would take that all out. And instead of saying, "Is God's hand so short that it cannot save?" they would say, "God is so powerful he can save anyone." They didn't want to act like maybe he had a hand or an arm, because that would make him sound too human. And I don't know if those exact verses were translated that way, but that was the basic idea. They believed that God's presence was in the temple, and specifically, especially in the Holy of Holies, which was a room kind of inside the inner courts of the temple, and only one person could enter there one time a year. It was a priest, and he had to jump through a million hoops and do all these sacrifices and ritual cleansings, all kinds of stuff, to be able to enter the Holy of Holies one time a year. And so this is a culture that really, like, God is wholly separate. You don't really get into his presence. You might defile him. It's very offensive to be a human being in his presence. So that is really what they emphasized. And a lot of that goes on today in Judaism. Mike and I went to Israel a couple of years ago. And I had been a couple times before, actually. My brother and sister-in-law lived in Jordan for several years. And so one time I visited them, and I would just kind of cross over the border and go to Israel. And my brother and sister are actually here visiting us for about a month now. But we went to Israel, Mike and I did, and we got to go up to the Temple Mount, which is the kind of the hill where we know for sure, 100% for sure, the temple was built here. And the foundation stones are still kind of there. That's where the Wailing Wall is, where Jewish people will go and pray. But the Temple Mount, the top of it, where the temple was built, is controlled by the Muslims. But they'll let you go up there. Not all day long, whatever, but they'll let you go up there. So we waited in line. There's this security point. It's, of course, you have to do a lot of security, because there are a lot of people that would like to bomb that place. The Dome of the Rock is there, that big, beautiful Muslim building. So we went in there, and there was a sign at the entrance, and I don't have a picture of it. I don't remember exactly what it said, but the gist of it was, if you are Jewish, you are not allowed to go up here. And this was not the Muslims that were saying this. This was the Jewish rabbis. This was the Orthodox Jews. They do not want you going up there if you're Jewish. Do you guys have any guess as to why? I don't know. So they know the temple was there. They know the Holy of Holies was there, but they don't know where it was. And they don't want you walking on the Holy of Holies. And so if you're an Orthodox Jew, like, you don't know where it is, and you might step on the Holy of Holies. And that would be incredibly offensive to God. They probably think you might be struck down dead, and at the very least, it's incredibly offensive to God for you to be walking around on the Holy of Holies. So that's why they're not allowed up there. So even today, like, this distance between God and man, highly emphasized. So if Jesus is a man, and he's saying, I'm going to be sitting in God's presence full time as his right hand man, that's pretty offensive to Jews of that day, and Jews of today, I believe, too. However, I don't think this was probably the most offensive part about what Jesus just said. He was referring to, when he's saying he's at the right hand of God, that's like saying, he's not just talking about like where he's sitting. He's saying, I'm ruling with God. It's kind of like saying, I'm equal to God. So it's not just about being in his presence. It's about, I have authority like God. I will be the judge. I will judge the earth. And these people, they knew their scriptures back and forth. And they knew that Jesus was referring to Psalm 110, verse 1. And this is a psalm of David that David wrote. Ironically, my husband preached on this about a couple months ago. I had no idea when I chose this passage that it was so much about this psalm. But the psalm says, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for your feet. So David is saying this, and basically, God is saying this to who the Jewish people believe to be the Messiah. And Jesus is saying, I'm at God's right hand. I'm the Messiah. From now on, I'm seated at God's right hand. And the Jewish people know that's what he's talking about. They know he's claiming to be the Messiah when he says that. And Jesus had talked about this passage in Luke chapter 20 a whole lot. He quotes in Luke chapter 20, Psalm 110, verses 1 through 2, he talks about, it says, David says, the Lord said to my Lord, sit at my right hand until I make your enemies a footstool for you. And then Jesus poses the question to the scribes. He says, how is it the people say the Christ is David's son if David calls him Lord? And Jesus doesn't answer that question there in Luke 20. And of course the scribes don't answer it because they don't want to go there. But he's saying, if he's David's Lord, he's above David. So he doesn't answer it there, but he answers it here, in this passage, at his trial, when he's about to be executed. He refers again to Psalms 110, and he says, I am the one seated at God's right hand. I am the king. I am the true judge. I am the fulfillment of this prophecy. So he answers this question. Interestingly, this verse, Psalm 110, 1 through 2, it is the most quoted Old Testament verse in the New Testament. So we know it was a big deal. This is how the Jewish people could say, okay, the Messiah is actually not just a man, the Messiah is actually equal to God. So this passage was really important to them. The guards had just ridiculed him, played this game of blind man's bluff the night before, ridiculing him as a prophet, but Jesus is saying, I'm more than a prophet. I'm the fulfillment of prophecy. I'm the Messiah. I am Lord. He's innocent in this sham joke of a trial, but he announces in the end, he's going to be the ultimate judge. He might be there being condemned by this stupid trial, but one day he will be judging the people judging him. That's a pretty bold claim to people who have the power to kill you. But he does it. He's not afraid. The council is obviously in shock, highly offended, and they respond, are you then the Son of God? And then Jesus comes back again with another pretty ambiguous reply. You say that I am. I don't know Hebrew, so I don't really know exactly what exactly he's saying here. It sounds strange. But the commentators say that what he's saying, he's saying yes, but it's a very mild yes. It's not very adamant. He is saying yes. He's definitely not saying, no, I'm not the Son of God. Just this kind of very yes, but not very strong. And so, but for the Jewish leadership, they say, we don't need any more testimony. We don't need any more witnesses. He's guilty. Let's take him to Pilate. Interestingly, Pilate, later on in this passage, Jesus gives him the exact same answer. You say that I am. But Pilate does something totally different with it. Pilate says, you're innocent. So it's this statement that one group says, we don't need any more testimony. You're definitely guilty. But another group says, oh, okay, you're innocent. So it's an interesting statement. So the whole council, scribes, Sanhedrin, Pharisees, Jesus, they all move on to Pilate. And they want a death penalty, okay? But we know that the Pilate isn't going to care about a Jewish theological dispute. Like, Pilate does not care. He does not believe in the Jewish religion. He believes in the Roman gods or whatever. He doesn't care if Jesus says he's their leader or Messiah or whatever. So the Jewish leadership know that they need to make it political to get him killed. So let's talk about Pilate. Who was he? Pilate was the fifth Roman governor of Judea, and he was in power from about AD 26 to AD 36. He's mentioned in several places other than the Bible. We know that he was real. We also know from the Gospels and from historical writings that the Jewish leadership, they were allowed to rule in some trials and punish some people and do some legal stuff, but they were not allowed to make a ruling that was a death penalty. They weren't allowed to kill anyone. And we know that that is true. So that's why they had to take him to Pilate. Otherwise, they would have just stoned him or whatever they would have done. But they needed a legal death penalty, so they had to take him to Pilate. So they bring him to Pilate, and they bring three charges against Jesus. They say, you're subverting the nation. He's telling people not to pay taxes to Caesar, and he's claiming to be Messiah. And Messiah is a king. That's what they say. So the first charge, subverting the nation, that's pretty ambiguous. Like, what does that mean? Does that mean you're, like, just kind of complaining against the guards? Or does that mean you've got an army and you're about to overthrow the country? Like, it's really ambiguous. You really don't know. I mean, who knows? Their charge about not paying taxes to Caesar, we know, was completely not true. If you guys remember a couple months ago, whole sermon on how Jesus says you need to pay to Caesar what you owe to Caesar and to God what it's God. So he said pay your taxes. So that was completely not true. So why did they say that? Obviously, I mean, we know they don't really care about the truth. They just want to get him killed. But this was a very strategic charge for the Pharisees to make against Jesus. First of all, because Pilate's number one job in being a governor of Judea was financial management of the province. He needed to get the money to Rome. So if Jesus is telling people, don't pay taxes, he is coming directly against Pilate being able to do his job, like the guy right there that's proceeding over this trial. So that was one reason they did it. But also, in that day, like, if you were a revolutionary, if you were thinking, I want Rome kicked out, the first strategy you started with was telling people not to pay their taxes. That was a sure sign of somebody that wanted to start a revolution and kick Rome out. So if you say, oh, look out for them, they're telling people not to pay taxes, that's like a big red flag. The Romans are going to be really worried, because that's what revolutionaries did. They said, don't pay your taxes. So interestingly enough, though, Pilate doesn't really talk about the taxes, which you'd think he'd be kind of worried about that. What he does talk about is them saying that Jesus claims to be a king. And interestingly, I mean, the Pharisees, I think they were pretty unfair with this when they say he claims to be Messiah, a king. Like, they just say Messiah is exactly a political king. And there's a lot of nuances to that, and there are some differences to what Messiah might mean and what a king is, but they just say he's going to be a political king and he's going to try to throw you out. That's what they're trying to say. And Pilate does pay attention to that. So he asks Jesus, are you the king of the Jews? And Jesus, again, he replies pretty ambiguously with the same answer he gave the Jewish council when they asked him if he was the son of God. Jesus says, you say that I am. But interestingly enough, Pilate takes it totally different. And after Jesus says, you say that I am, Pilate says, you're innocent. He declares him innocent. He says, I find no legal grounds for punishing this guy. He's innocent. And today, We would hope, at least. Like, this is like a trial that's gone to the Supreme Court. It's the top court of the land. Pilate is the governor of this province. The buck stops with him. So if you bring the trial to the Supreme Court and the judge declares you innocent, that should be the end of it, right? Should be, but not in this case, because of politics. So Pilate declares him innocent, but the Jewish leaders will not have it. This cannot be the end of that. They say he's stirring up people all over Judea. He started all the way off in Galilee, and he's come all the way here. You have to take this guy seriously. You cannot just let him go. And Pilate, like, he doesn't want to make the Jewish leadership mad. Like, Rome really did not want a rebellion in Israel. There were a couple more after that. They were bloody. They were bad. They did not want that. So Pilate wants to keep the Jewish leadership happy. And they were not going to take no for an answer. But something else that the Jewish leadership said catches Pilate's attention there. Galilee. Galilee. He says, Galilee? He's a Galilean? Conveniently, Herod Antipas, who was the Tetrarch of Galilee at the time, he was in Jerusalem for the Passover. So you guys have probably caught on to this, but everybody's coming to Jerusalem for Passover. It was the biggest religious feast of the year, and you were supposed to come to Jerusalem for the Passover. So, like, everybody who's anybody and their cousin Joe, they're all in Jerusalem for the Passover. So Herod Antipas is there too. He's half Jewish. He's there, we assume, celebrating the Passover. It's just what you do. So Pilate says, you know, he's a Galilean. And Pilate decides to send Jesus to Herod. Now, why would he do this is the question. It almost sounds like, from the way that Luke words it, that it's really Herod's responsibility and not Pilate's, because Jesus is a Galilean. But that's not true. Pilate is in he's a higher authority than Herod. He does not have to send Jesus to Herod. He decides to do this for some other reason. He has jurisdiction over Judea. So regardless of where somebody's from, if they do something in Judea, Pilate's the governor of Judea, and he gets to say what happens. It doesn't matter. You know, if you're from Indiana, you commit a crime in Indiana, Indiana gets to say what happens to you. It doesn't matter if you're from Texas. So that was kind of the situation, but he still sends him to Herod. And so we just kind of wonder, like, why? And there are a few reasons this was a really smart move on his part, politically at least, I think. I think in part, Pilate didn't want to take full responsibility for killing an innocent man. He would like to put some of that responsibility on somebody else who was Jewish. Because even though the Jewish leadership wanted Jesus taken care of, the Jewish people really liked Jesus. And if they knew that Pilate put him to death, they would hate Jesus. And Pilate's, you know, constantly trying to keep a rebellion from happening, So I don't think he wanted to take full responsibility for this. And Herod was also closer in culture to Jesus. Herod was from this area. Pilate was from Rome. Like, he didn't know. He wasn't Jewish. He didn't grow up there. This is a foreign country to him. So I think he kind of wants another opinion. Like, Herod, you understand the situation more than I do. You understand the Jewish religion more than I do. I want your opinion on this. So he sends him to Herod, I think in part for that reason. But the third reason was the craftiest political reason of all. And I think, like, I don't know, I have to kind of respect Pilate as a politician for doing this. I mean, Pilate and Herod, as Luke says, they were at odds. And historical writers of that time also say Pilate and Herod hated each other. So why? Why did they hate each other? Well, a lot of things. Pilate had a real knack at doing really offensive things to the Jewish culture. Like, really. Like, if you want to really make him mad, like, Pilate just, I don't know if he didn't know what he was doing or he just didn't care, but he did a number of things that made the Jewish people really, really mad, including Herod Antipas. And at one point, he did something really, really offensive. And Herod and some other Jewish leaders actually complained to Emperor Tiberius all the way in Rome, and the emperor forced Pilate to reverse what he had done. He was like, you got to quit that. You got to stop it. You got to make it right. And Pilate had to do it. And Herod's family, even though Herod was, he was a lower position than Pilate, but Herod's family was buddy-buddy with the imperial family in Rome. Like, they were close. So So Pilate knew it was in his best interest to get along with Herod. So like, it's like somebody, like, say you're pretty high up in a company and you're above, you know, the boss's best friend or son. Like, you've been there longer, you're in a higher position, so you have more authority than them, but they're really close to the CEO. You probably want them on your side, even if they're kind of lower in power. So it was kind of like that. He wanted him to be on his side. So let's talk about Herod. We hear about Herod all the time in the Gospels. It's like he's around forever, right? he just keeps going and going. And that's because there are like three of them in the Gospels. And it gets really confusing as to which is which. So little quiz, Bible knowledge. Which Herod was around when Jesus was born? Herod the Great. That's right, Herod the Great. And he was actually the only one that was technically a king. Who was the Herod that had John the Baptist beheaded? Antipas. So this one right here that we're talking about, he's the one that had John the Baptist beheaded and his head put on a silver platter. That was Herod Antipas. Herod was more like, it was kind of like a last name more than a first name. So Herod the Great had like, I don't know how many sons, and he like killed a couple of them because he was jealous of them or whatever. But he named them all Herod. And they had different other titles, Herod Antipas, Herod this, Herod that. So Herod Antipas was one of his sons. And when Herod the Great died, Rome, who really, you know, was in charge of everything, even though Herod was the king, Rome divided out his kingdom. So they didn't just say, okay, here's your oldest son, he gets the whole kingdom. What Rome did instead was they divided parts of Israel between different people, different sons of Herod. But for Judea, which is where Jerusalem is, they decided it was going to be directly under Roman control. So they would bring in Roman governors like Pilate, and Pilate was the fifth of those governors. So Judea used to be part of Herod's father's kingdom, and now Pilate is ruling it. So you have to think, in Herod's mind, he's thinking, this should really be mine, and you have it, you foreign Roman. So he, you know, I mean, the odds were against them being friends from the very beginning, and Pilate knows that, but he also knows it's probably in my best interest to be on good terms with Herod. So they bring Jesus to Herod. This is a really smart political move by Pilate. And Herod is delighted. He is so excited. He's been waiting for a long time. He's wanted to see Jesus for a long time because he hears about all these miracles and signs and wonders that Jesus is doing. And he wants to see Jesus do something, you know, in front of him. And I mean, surely Jesus will. I mean, he's about to be killed. Doesn't he not want to be executed? Jesus should do anything for him. Signs, wonders, whatever, right? No, Jesus doesn't play that way. So he wants him to do a sign or a miracle, but Jesus doesn't. He asks him a million questions. Jesus won't even answer his questions. He just won't even respond to him. And Herod tries and tries and tries, and eventually he just gets fed up. He's like, forget you. The scribes and Pharisees are on the sidelines the entire time, like they have been the whole time, accusing Jesus, ridiculing him, mocking him. And finally, Herod just joins with them. And his soldiers just join in with him, and they start mocking Jesus. And Herod just says, forget it. And so he puts what they call an elegant robe on Jesus and sends him back to Pilate. Now, scholars are divided on what this robe actually was. An elegant robe could mean one of two things. It might have meant a beautiful white robe, in which case this would have been a sign of Jesus' innocence. And there are a lot of scholars that think that that's what it was. And part of the reason they think this is because Pilate later on, he says, Herod declared Jesus as innocent. And a lot of scholars think that's how Pilate knew that Herod declared him innocent, was because he came back with a white robe on. It's not for sure. We don't totally know. But a lot of people think that's why Pilate thought Herod found Jesus innocent. The other interpretation is it could have been a purple robe, which would mean royalty, majesty, a king. And they were trying to mock him for claiming to be a king. I mean, it went right along with the crown of thorns. So the passage begins with him being mocked for being a prophet and ends with him being mocked for being a king. And Luke closes the passage was saying, that day Herod and Pilate became friends. Before they had been enemies. So Pilate's political move worked. He was probably pretty pleased with himself. And on the surface, there was a reconciliation of sorts. How deep, we don't know, but there was a reconciliation between the Jewish leader and the Gentile leader of that area. And the church fathers looked at this. These were men who were really godly people, early Christians, like 400, 500, 300 AD. When they looked at this, they really thought that there was a deeper symbolism in this than just Herod and Pilate kind of made up. They said that this was a sign of the gospel and Jesus' suffering, which he was suffering in this, reconciling Jews and Gentiles. And that is part of what the gospel does. It brings us in with the people of God, with the Jewish people, and it reconciles the Jews with the Gentiles. And experts today don't think that that's what it was about, but I think the church fathers, I think they were onto something. The gospel does reconcile us with the people of God and grafts us in to be part of the people of God. So what do we do with all this? This is a passage, it's kind of hard to know, like, what's the application? I think that, as I said in the beginning, thinking about Jesus' suffering, abuse, the injustice that happened in this trial that was really totally a joke. Like, it's sad, but we need to know that our sin brought Jesus to that point, and that God, he takes sin very seriously. And Lent is a time that you think about that. You meditate on that. It's maybe not fun, but it is necessary for us to think about and understand the consequences of our sin and how Christ had pay the penalty for that, and God takes that very, very seriously. This dark hour that Jesus refers to talks about that. And so as we practice Lent, and you know, some of us are fasting from different things, we think about and pray that God would show us the sin in our lives and cleanse us of that. And we think about the effects of that sin. And so we take the season to think about Christ's suffering for that sin. So we take communion this morning. I want us to remember that the bread and the wine are a symbol of this very suffering that Jesus went through, and the blood that he was shed, these very stories that we're going through over these next few weeks and Holy Week. It's a symbol of this, and it's a symbol of our reconciliation and being grafted in with the people of God. Paul writes in Corinthians, before the Gospel of Luke was ever composed, he writes, "For whenever you eat this bread and drink this cup, you proclaim the Lord's death until he comes." So let's do this in remembrance of him.